Hello, welcome once again to our program, Middle Age Can Be Your Best Age. I'm your host and helmsman, Roy Richards, helping you navigate through the uncharted waters of middle age. Heck no, you and I are not over the hill at age 40, 50, even 60. We can take control of our emotions and look forward to the future at any age. Most of us, for most of us, our crowning achievements and our best years are yet to come. With some responsible, positive thinking, a shot of self-confidence, a few ambitious yet realistic goals, and a willingness to work hard and take chances, you'll be on the road to a brighter tomorrow also. Having said these positive words, I must add a word of warning. Please don't sit back and rely upon anyone else, Uncle Sam, your employer, a fast horse, the lottery jackpot, or fate to present you with a bountiful, stress-free future. For all but an extremely lucky few, things just don't work out that way. Take a moment to assess your life at middle age. Are you satisfied with where you are at today? Are you fulfilled in your current career, proud of where you work and what you do? Do the tasks you perform make you feel good or contribute significant value to others? Is your life in balance, leaving ample time for fun and relaxation, positive relationships, personal growth, and community service? Are you comfortable with personal and family finances, or does money always seem to run out before all the bills are paid? Are you saving for the future? Is your career or life in general stressing you out and thereby putting a stress on your or a strain on your marriage and family relationships? Sadly, for too many of us at middle age, we're disillusioned with the life we have chosen and with what we have become. As our guest today will explain, if your life right now disappoints you, you have two choices. One, you can recommit to the American dream, as he calls it, relying on yourself to challenge the future by targeting success, taking risk, working hard, and sacrificing for the future. Or your second choice, like so many people do today, you classify yourself as a victim, blame circumstances or others for past failures and present unhappiness, and then you wait for someone else to take control and bail you out. Ask yourself, which path do you choose? Our guest today, Dean Walco, is here to help guide us back to the self-reliant American dream. Dean was a college professor for 20 years, and he owns a consulting business and also has worked in the public sector. He is author of 4 books presently available on Amazon.com, including his latest, which he'll talk about today, The Choices and Consequences of Our Age, The Disintegrating Economic, Political, and Societal Institutions of the United States. Sounds pretty disheartening, doesn't it? In his book, Dean succinctly details how we as a country have arrived at the present sad state where few Americans today believe in the common good over their own needs, and most of us have abdicated responsibility for control of our own destinies. I highly recommend Dean's book if you want to understand the history behind our present entitlement mentality and how this is leading to our nation's downfall. As Dean puts it, too many of us have become utterly dependent upon our employer for a livelihood, the government for health care and retirement, and the wealthy, or as President Obama would put it, those millionaires and billionaires, to pay the nation's taxes. On last week's program, we cautioned you not to depend solely upon your employer. Since few of us are under contract, we could be only a moment's away from the unemployment line. And given the ballooning federal budget deficit and unsustainable growth in entitlement programs, it doesn't make too much sense to stake your financial future upon Uncle Sam. So I guess you and I had better appoint ourselves CEO of our own destinies, and that's why I've invited Dean here today. I will ask him to share with us how we can defy the norm and return to the traditional American dream, relying on that wonderful engine within to launch our journey to success and happiness on our own terms while we willingly serve others. Hello, Dean, and welcome to our program.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here. I sincerely appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, before we talk about restoring our own self-reliance, please give us a brief history of the nation's drive to be a utopian society, as you call it, and how this has led to the sorry state our country is in today.
Well, the defining event that I often look at is World War II, and that was really a societal change of a significant magnitude, not simply because of the war, but because of the mentality of the United States after the war. Prior to the war, although it had been escalating, the government and society was very much independent. I use the term the rugged individual. It was really go as you own, make it on your own. There's very little, very, very little influence, impact of the government in society at that time. I think it was a time that most people believe doesn't exist anymore or didn't exist in the past, but it certainly did. The very first federal income tax only affected 1% of the country. Can you imagine only 1% of the country paying 1%? An absolute amazing amount. But World War II was a defining event because it was probably the apex of dominance for the United States. During that time in World War II, we were responsible after World War II for 40% of the goods and services in the world. Can you imagine one country with 6% of the population producing 40% of goods and services?
Wow.
That absolute magnitude of control over the economy allowed the United States to grow the social system to a point with Social Security, eventually Medicare, unemployment insurance, Medicare, Medi-Cal, any type of health care. And that in and of itself has created a country that moved away from the independent nature to more so the dependent nature. And it took 40, 50 years, but that's where we are today.
Yeah, and unfortunately today we can't afford what we're doing and what we've set up. It keeps growing faster than the revenues we're bringing in.
Absolutely. Well, I talk about in the book that the central issue of our time is that the good job no longer exists, that good job that pays about $18 an hour with benefits.
Yeah.
It doesn't exist because in the late 1940s, the additional cost to employ somebody was about 5%, and that would have been for any of those additional ancillary costs. Today, it's over 30%. So if you're an American business and you want to hire somebody, just the costs alone outside of salary are going to be 30%. Well, you can move that job to Mexico, even Canada, but certainly to India, China, and evade most of that 30%. By the way, Roy, this is in addition to the legal statutes, the regulations, the policies, the rules, the union requirements, all of those requirements that may not necessarily be economic. So you can see how it's very difficult to have a job, to create a job, to sustain a job in the United States over the last 20 years, certainly beginning in the late 70s when Japan and West Germany at the time and other European countries had rebuilt from World War II. They were able to compete very successfully with the United States, and that's where you saw jobs moving out of the United States because the economic and political economy just wasn't conducive to creating and sustaining a business. That, to me, is really the foundation of what has caused so much angst and what I call instability and insecurity within our society.
Yeah. We could spend hours and hours talking about that. But let's cut here to the chase to try to help our listeners a little bit with their own destinies. Why does it make sense to admire and start acting like millionaires and other successful individuals rather than like so many of us are just jealous of them and envy their success?
That's one of the most critical issues that we have. I would say it's not just the rich and poor that we talk about. It's union, non-union, young versus old, educated versus not educated, foreign-born versus U.S.-born. There always seems to be these groups that people are put into. When you put yourself in a group, you often tend to look at other groups and what they have. That's exactly what's happened with the rich and not rich. The rich and the poor. I don't tend to look at it as a rich and poor issue. I look at it as a success in what you do. There's many people that aren't wealthy that are very successful because they follow their passion in life and they've battled their adversities and they overcome their burdens and they've really left a great legacy, and that's something to be admired, not so much the zeros that they have in the bank account. But as far as the rich and the poor issue, Thomas Jefferson said in his first inaugural address, I'll never forget it, he said that we should not take from those who've acquired much through their own effort just to spare those who've acquired little through their lack of effort.
Yeah.
And that was one of the founders of our country. And what he's saying is that you should be able to keep what you make. Take care of society, absolutely, but you should be able to keep what you make through your own effort. You, thankfully, brought up about the six attributes that I look at of a person who is successful. That person had a great idea. They worked hard. They sacrificed. Those are all important attributes. Yes, they had a little bit of luck, and they had a little bit of help as well, but it really started with somebody who sacrificed so much of their life. I talk about, Roy, which I think is very important, is we today have what I call an output society, is that people judge the output. So they look at the rich, but no one looks at, Roy, how they became rich.
Yeah.
They want the consequences of the work, but they don't want to look at what it took to get that money. And here's what I mean by that. There's maybe somebody who has made quite a bit of money, but maybe they never got married or didn't have very many kids, if kids at all. Or they may have worked two and three jobs. They may have never went on a vacation. Yes, at the end of their life, they're wealthy, but they've given up so much of their life to have that wealth. There's a lot of people who have given up wealth so that they can enjoy their family, their free time, their golfing, their traveling. And that's the crux of my book, Roy, which is choices and consequences.
Yeah.
You make choices in life, and then there are consequences to it, and you do have to live with those consequences.
And the whole key is you decide which destiny you want, whether it's the wealth or the balanced life or whatever, and you make those sacrifices that are needed. It kills me when I think about it. It doesn't make a lot of sense. Does it really elevate me personally to bring someone down to my level rather than the striving to increase my wealth up to their level? I mean, just bringing them down to me is not going to enhance the life for either of us. And I also thought it was very interesting in your book where you point out that I think it was only 8% of wealth is inherited, and that 80%, I think, of wealthy individuals, you say, are like first-generation wealthy, so that it's not a bunch of people getting a free handout, like so many people like to believe.
Absolutely. 70%, there's another statistic, 70% of Forbes 400 are self-made. That's a fantastic statistic, all three of those. And the reason why is because there's a great deal of hope for people who are in their middle age, or if they have grandkids or kids, they should tell their kids, hey, if you want to make it, if you want to make it, this is a country where you can. If you don't want to make it, this is a country where you can't make it either. But there is still that great hope that I think exists in this country, given that 80% of the people are first-generation wealthy. I think of all the failings of American society, the most damaging is that lack of what I call that personal responsibility. It seems few take responsibility for their actions, and instead, if they choose to live a life of irresponsibility or carelessness or laziness, they quit school or eat unhealthy or avoid exercise or spend money foolishly, refuse to upgrade their professional knowledge, display a negative or dismissive attitude, maybe fail to commit to your job, and yet they should envy or be jealous of somebody else who does do that, there is something that I think is so unfortunate about those type of people.
Yeah, you know, thinking back on the golden interludes, as I call them in my book, and thinking about it in my life, the times when I was really engaged in what I was doing and had a great relationship with spouse and family and looked forward to the future, I really didn't envy anyone else at that time. Didn't want to change my life with anyone else in the world. And I think it's so clear that if you are self-reliant and are really concentrating on what you want out of your own life and have chosen your priorities, you're not going to worry so much about what somebody else has.
Absolutely. Even back in the day, it was believed that you earned money fairly and spend it responsibly. Now, many believe that money is earned unfairly and spent selfishly. So we should take it from those who earned it and redistribute it to those who did not. many in government, I think, advanced this thought, and
yes,
and as a result, many incentives and deductions cease for those who have a higher income. This is consistent, I believe, too, Roy, with the common refrain to raise taxes on the most successful so that you can redistribute it to the least successful. And what's most interesting about that is both individuals are clamoring for money.
Yeah.
The one people who earned it just want to keep it. The other side who didn't earn it just want to take it. So they're both after the money, and we have to ask ourselves as a society, who is more entitled to it? And I think that's really a fundamental question when we talk about what's appropriate taxes or what's appropriate.
And the other ridiculous assumption is that it's a constant pot, that you just, if you take it from the rich and give to the poor, that the pot will not shrink at all, and that the rich will not have less incentives to further their wealth and to generate income just because they have to give it to somebody else. Doesn't matter to them.
Exactly. I look at two things when I look at wealth. One is, was it acquired fairly, justly? And with few instances, I truly believe most of wealth is acquired fairly and justly. My parents own a small business. I have a small business. So I think that's the fundamental issue that you look at. The second fundamental issue is, can somebody else acquire that wealth? In other words, if I acquire a dollar, does that mean that somebody else can't acquire a dollar? And that's not... Of course not. So with those two instances, whenever we talk about wealth, I think there's much to be applauded for people who have done something worthwhile with their life, and as a result of what they've done, they've acquired some financial stability. We should applaud that. If nothing else, we should study that, learn the lessons of what they've done, and apply it to our own lives and our own children's lives and grandchildren's lives.
Amen.
Go ahead.
No, I just said amen. I couldn't agree more.
It seems like that jealousy and envy of I don't have it, I want what somebody else has, is so destructive to a society. It's also destructive to our political process, because rather than politicians using the money that they receive wisely, they right away blame others for not paying enough, and therefore it's the people who don't pay enough that should be the blame for that. It's very much a blame society. I appreciate you bringing out in the book that I talk about the American dreamers and the American blamers. It's not just society that blames. It's also the political system that blames. And you started the conversation by talking about the country and its origin, and I made a quote about Jefferson, but it really was a self-initiated self-responsibility society, very low government. In fact, taxes, as you know, outside of wars, were new to this country until the early 1900s. And so they existed by very much, hey, this is a country that we're going to allow you to be what you want to be, but you're also going to have to accept responsibility of the choices that you make. And we talked about the instability and insecurity and where that happened when people started to give, as you mentioned earlier, more responsibility to others to manage their own life, whether it was their employer, whether it was their government, whether it was their family. When they started to move some of that responsibility, I call it abdicate that responsibility to others, it's no wonder when those others, whoever they are, can no longer provide it, that there's a great sense of instability and insecurity out there.
Yeah, there sure is. Well, shaking off past failures and disappointments, how does a person of middle age choose to be a winner? Say, how do I forget all the failures and disappointments I've had up to now and refocus myself on being a winner? What would you suggest?
Oh, my favorite piece of advice, Roy, is four letters, and it's next. I learned that many years ago. I've been teaching for 20 years, but I also work in the public sector and have a business. But my favorite word is next. And because that means as long as you have next, no matter what your age is, 5, 10, 50, 75, as long as you have next, which is the next day, the next hour, then there's a sense of positivity and, yes, excitement about the future. The business venture failed, but you have what's next. You lose your job, focus on what's next. If you can constantly focus on what's next and not what's past, I think that it gives you that anticipation for the future, the desire to get up in the next day. You know, I've written, this is my fifth book now, and a couple of them didn't do so well, but I always looked forward to writing the next one because the next one just might make it. It's that which I think keeps you going. So no matter what failure you have in life, as long as you can concentrate on that, you'll be okay. Here's the second piece of advice that I would give. I have this saying that says, go down swinging. Pretty popular. Some people in baseball say, swing for the fences. Very similar. But I say, go down swinging. The fear of failure and the fear of what other people think has destroyed the ambitions of most people or most men. And what I mean by that, Roy, is people are so consumed with failure that they don't want to fail. Our people are
one,
so
two,
consumed.
Three strikes, you're out instead of swing for the fences.
There's another one. There's another one, too. And that fear of what other people think, you know, if you fail and no one sees you, is it still a failure? I think most people look at what others will think of their failure and admitting to other people that they failed, whether it's a marriage that failed and you have to tell your parents, oh, I don't want to tell my parents. And I think it's those two things. When I look at people who are apprehensive about the future, worried about the future, I ask them two things. What would happen if you fail? Not much. And the second thing is do you really care what other people think? If you're so concerned that other people are going to judge you differently because you failed, or because you've done this in your life or that in your life, if you're so concerned with that, it is going to destroy any ambition that you have. So my advice has always been, especially to the younger people who are just starting out in a career, is don't worry about failure. Get as much education as you can. Do as much work as you can. Meet as many people as you can. And then go out there and do something. Don't fear failure and don't fear what other people think, and you're going to be okay.
Yeah, that when you mention a marriage failing, it reminds me that, you know, does it fail if you're happier now than you were before? Your ex-spouse is happy and prospering outside the prior relationship, and your children are taken care of, and they're happy and content, then it's not really a failure. It's really moving forward if the two of you really weren't getting along together and weren't proceeding as a loving couple. So that definition of failure by the very term doesn't make a lot of sense in some cases. Now, it can be a failure, obviously, if both parties are miserable after the divorce, but not necessarily if they're both thriving.
That's true. You can certainly be consumed with the past or consumed with the future. And I, for one, is consumed with the future. What I've done in the past is done, and I can't change it, but I certainly can change what's in the future.
I like to say that the past only should be a reference. You don't regret the past. You just consult it to see what you did wrong and what you do differently in the future.
That's very wise. That's very wise. We have a saying in our household that we said every morning and every night, always look for the good along the road of life. Mm-hmm. So wherever you're at, whatever you're doing, always look for the good. You know, say hi to someone, say bye to somebody. Look at the flowers along the way, not just the cement. And I think that if you have that kind of focus, that sense of positivity within your life that pervades your life, those things that we talk about, failures and disappointments and disillusionments, really don't consume us. Do they impact us in some way? Sure, it's impossible not to. But they don't consume you. They don't consume your life. They don't make you paralyzed about what's coming next. And so we always do try to look to the good. And I think that there's a lot of good in this country. I think there's a lot to admire. But the focus isn't on where it should be. And I think that if we were to get back to the type of opportunities that we had for the average American, whether they're just starting their job or they're starting a second job at 50 years old, if we get back to what those opportunities are, I think that people really will have more stability and security in their life because they've taken a bit more ownership in the direction of their life.
Well, can I begin to look, feel, think, and act like a millionaire before I actually become rich?
You can. You absolutely can. I don't think... Here's the thing about money. I think most people who've had some success will understand that money certainly gives you options in your life.
Yeah.
the options to continue
by
working.
I didn't mean, by the way, spending money like a millionaire before I have it. That won't really put you in the, I mean, just start thinking of yourself as you want to be. That's what I always tell people to do, that you know, you picture in your mind really specifics. You say, you don't say, I just want a house by the lake. You say, I want a $500,000 summer home on the west shore of Lake Tahoe. You know, you specifically focus in on what you really want to be doing with the rest of your life to earn a living, what you would enjoy doing, and specifically hone in on all those things that you would do and act and think once you become a millionaire, and then that puts you on the road to just what you're targeting.
Absolutely. You know, I wrote a book called The Great People of Our Time, and I got to interview some interesting people. And one of the things that I learned, which is exactly what you said about spending, is that people who have obtained some sense of financial security watch more about what they spend than about what they earn. They concentrate much more on what they do with the money when they have it than how to get more of it. And I think there's a lesson there, and that lesson is that wealth is really created by watching what you spend rather than obtaining more of what you have. I think that lesson is lost in the political realm. They tend to spend more money on, or more time on taxes and revenue generation than finding out how they can spend the money that they have more wisely. And so I think that correlation is lost. And because of that, and because of the dominance of the political system, we see more people concentrating on, and this is the interesting paradox, more people concentrating on rich rather than how they become rich or what they did with the money when they had it.
I thought it's fascinating in your book how you talk about the government spending more money than they're taking in, but rather than investing in the future through education and infrastructure and things like that, it's just going into entitlements. So effectively, you're just borrowing against the future and not really giving the future generations anything in return for the money, which is really a disturbing factor.
It's terrible. It's absolutely terrible. Any person in this country should be worried about it. I'm not telling anybody anything that they don't know. If they read just about any article, most people, I'm convinced, don't want to hear it because it is so depressing. There's a couple statistics that I have that are so terrible, which is in 1969, 33% of federal money, 33% was spent on individuals, what we call transfer payments, and 33% was on infrastructure, research, and education. And in 2010, 60% of the federal budget was spent on transfer payments or on individuals. That would be like Medicare, Social Security, Medicaid, and only 16% on infrastructure.
Yeah.
So, again, what's critical to that is we in the 60s, we spent 33% on Social Security, Medicare, and those. Now we're spending 60%. And where'd that money come from? You talk about taking a dollar from one to the other. We took that money directly from infrastructure, research, and education. We spent half today than we did in 1960 as a percentage on infrastructure, research, and development. That trend is continuing. In the 1960s, 2% of our GDP, this isn't the federal budget, but the gross domestic product, 2% of the country's 2.7 was in what we consider entitlements. Now it's 10%. It's nearly impossible to create the infrastructure, the research, the educated citizenry. It's virtually impossible to do that when you have so much of your budget going into what is affectionately called transfer payment or entitlements.
Yeah.
You don't build the type of society that you want when you have that kind of money going directly into those kinds of expenses.
Well, I sort of violated what I said I wasn't going to do. I got our discussion going toward what's wrong with the country. We're almost out of time, but at the end of your, I'd like you to talk about the end of your book. You present a very intriguing little illustration, which I think effectively summarizes our opportunities in life. Tell us about your illustration of the backpack that each of us is given at birth. I really like that
Well, I appreciate that very much. It's probably my my favorite story, and it has some relevance to my book. But I do believe that at birth, that everybody is given certain talents, traits, characteristics, whatever they may be. I don't care who you are. Everybody's given something, and at birth, I think sometimes I have this visual of you getting a backpack, and all throughout your life, what you're supposed to do is to acquire accomplishments based on what your talents and characteristics are. To this day, I carry a backpack every day, and it reminds me that I want to do something. I want to do something with my life. I've always believed that if you spend your life doing good, you get more life out of it. And so I want to continue to focus on doing good all throughout my days. I think I'll live longer, I'll live happier. And then at the end of the day, you have this backpack. And you may sit on a porch and you open up the backpack and these are all the accomplishments that you've had in your life. I'm paralyzed with opening a backpack and not having any accomplishments. In other words, of not doing good with the time that I have. So I hope that this book and this time that I spent with you and everything that I'm doing is seen by people as good, that it's worthy of their time, and I can put it in my backpack as an accomplishment that I've done, and then I'll now work on my next one.
Yeah, amen. We don't have much time left, but tell us, Dean, how a listener can best obtain your book, The Choices and Consequences of Our Age.
Well, first of all, I appreciate the time. Thank you so much. The book is called The Choices and Consequences of Our Age, The Disintegrating Economic, Political, and Societal Institutions of the United States. You can certainly get it on Amazon.com, www.amazon.com. All my books are there. Type in my name. Type in the title of the book. It's there now. I appreciate it. I think it's a great read. I think it's very interesting. Hopefully it's non-political, and it gives you quite a bit of background about why we're here, not so much blaming individuals or groups, but telling you the history of it, and then also what we can do in the future.
Yeah, that's the key, is what we as citizens can do to get some responsible politicians in there that are willing to tell us what really needs to be done. Don't keep pushing it down the road so that instead of a manageable, I don't know if it's still manageable or not, but I know if it goes too much further, we're all going to have Greek-like problems that you know, won't
very
be manageable
much
without tremendous sacrifice. Well, thank you so much, Dean, for joining us today. You presented some real discouraging facts, and yet at the same time you have inspired us to look within for solutions rather than depending on someone else for a better life. And as I normally do, I encourage you to go to my website, www.middleagerenewal.com, and take a look at my book, A Midlife Challenge Wake Up, which offers a comprehensive roadmap along with 21 self-help exercises which can guide you to a positive, self-reliant future. And I would also like to put in a good word for a guest we had a few weeks back, Steve Michaels, and his new book, How to Die with a Smile on Your Face. Steve offers a highly intriguing and inspiring formula for awakening to your full potential and transforming your life by writing your own obituary, and examines where you are today and what really matters to you. And you can preview Steve's book at www.howtodiewithasmileonyourface.com. As they say in another ad, that's a long name but amazing results. Well, that's our show for today. Thanks for tuning in. I'm your host, Roy Richards, the Human Alarm Clock. Tune in again next week when we'll talk about preventing and arresting decline in your business. Until then, please remember, middle age is your prime time.